Welcome to the Coder Catch Up podcast. My name is Jamie Jones, and this episode we'll be joined by Andrew Nesbitt. You probably know him from a few open source projects, a few general projects. Main one that you've probably heard about is 24 pull requests, followed by libraries IO, and recently launched dependency CI. So welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. Do you have a nickname or anything you want to be called by? Is Andrew fine?
No, Andrew's great. Andrew's get really annoyed when I introduce myself as Andrew and people shorten it to Andy.
Oh, really? What I wanted to just introduce yourself a bit, give the audience a little rundown of who you are and what you kind of do on a day-to-day basis.
Sure. So I've been a freelance developer for the past couple of years. Before then, worked at GitHub as a Rails engineer, and I've been doing mostly Ruby on Rails focused work for the past, I want to say something like 8 years. I've been working on Rails for a long time, building web focused apps for startups or existing businesses. And over the past few years, I've been getting more and more into open source and trying to help people contribute back to open source software, and then kind of just recently keep on top of the huge amount of open source software as it's kind of exploded, and there's been more and more produced, and then kind of transitioning into more of a product focused business with libraries IO and dependency CI, which hopefully I'll be working on them full time very soon.
Yeah, for sure. The open source explosion with projects is astronomical. Mainly, I think, from the Node projects. Have you found the Node projects are growing the most, or
JavaScript has definitely exploded both in the browser and Node on the server. But the browser is definitely the thing that is pushing JavaScript most. It's because it's the biggest install base of any kind of runtime. I think everywhere runs JavaScript, right?
Yeah, for sure. Like I noticed on libraries.io, you've mentioned there that you're tracking over 1.5 million open source libraries.
Yeah, it's when I started the project, I think it had about 800,000. So it's almost doubled in the past year and a half.
That's crazy. And I know you've had a lot of database upgrades lately. You've had at least a couple just from the sheer quantity of data.
Yeah. So last time I counted, there was 170 million rows in the Postgres database, which I'm trying to run it on the kind of keep it fairly cheap. It was on a machine with about 32 gigs of RAM. And over the weekend, the indexes reached almost the total amount of RAM, which if your indexes in Postgres get bigger than the amount of RAM available, everything kind of falls to pieces.
Yeah, like that's astronomical. I couldn't believe it when I seen some of your tweets. It was really surprising to see how much data had been put in there.
Well, it's also collecting every GitHub repository, open source GitHub repository that it sees. There's a Firehose API that you can follow that shows when every new commit and every new project is published on GitHub, and libraries is watching that every second or so and adding and keeping update all the dependencies for all those different applications. So you get a picture of it tries to draw the network of the whole of the open source ecosystem.
Yeah, that's amazing. So does that just any kind of public repository that it attracts, or is there some kind of smarts in there to determine, if there's a certain amount of activity on it or something like that?
So it tracks everything apart from forks, because it just causes a huge amount more data with very little benefit. But for everything it sees, it's going to record at least the GitHub repository and the people that have contributed to it. And then if it has one of the kind of manifest files for a package manager, so something like package.json or gem file or what's the NuGet, the .NET one, I think is called, used to be called project.json, might be something different now. There's so many different ones. But it'll record all of the dependencies for each of those files. So if you've got a gem file and a package JSON for your Ruby application, then it'll record all of those and it'll link them together with the things that it depends upon, so it can kind of tell you about new versions of the things that you use.
Right. And does that tie in then to dependency CI through that particular, like where you have a package JSON and a gem file, does that really tightly integrate well with dependency CI?
Yeah, so the dependency CI is using a lot of the same code under the hood. It passes all of your dependencies in the same way. And then rather than just keeping track of them and telling you about new versions, it actually does a kind of a code review on those dependencies. So it's looking to see, has each dependency got a license, make sure it's not been marked as deprecated or unmaintained, and make sure it's not been removed from the package manager so you don't end up with left pad-like situations.
Yeah, yeah, that certainly has stirred the hornet's nest a bit there. A little bit scary, I think. What are your thoughts on that whole fiasco?
Yeah, so NPM have locked that down now, which makes it much harder for that to happen directly. But anyone can still release a new version that's broken, or that you could even publish a new version with no code, which could potentially cause people lots of pain. Some package managers are even worse than that. So the Go one and Bower, which is used for front-end development, don't even have kind of a store of the published versions. They're just on GitHub. So if someone deletes their GitHub repository, then it's just gone. Your dependency has disappeared. And those package managers tend to kind of encourage you to put all your dependencies straight into your GitHub repository rather than kind of downloading them every time that you set them up on a new machine.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, one of the other things too with Bower, which I used to love Bower when it first came out, but the problem was it started to get littered with the same kind of repository but slightly different. Like there'd be the same GitHub repository but a slightly different name, or it was a fork that someone had made and then they put it in there, and like you'd search for jQuery and you'd get four or five different versions of jQuery on there.
Yeah, so that's a tricky thing with Bower. They don't really do any kind of uniqueness on the GitHub repository, so anyone can publish anyone's stuff on Bower. The search that they used to have was awful because it wouldn't tell you kind of which things were the one that most people were using, but they've actually switched to using libraries for their search on their website, which is pretty neat. So any query you do on the Bower homepage is actually using the library's API directly, and that looks at everyone who depends on Bower projects, and will, so for all the different Bower names that are actually the jQuery repo, it'll order them by the ones which are most depended on. So you end up with only seeing the kind of the one that everyone uses rather than the random ones that people have published of funny names.
Well, yeah, that's amazing. That's really handy. So besides libraries IO being this great resource, it's also helping other package managers do a better job, essentially. At least that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, so I'm trying to encourage the best practices and make it easy to find the right things to use, because otherwise the NPM search has traditionally been pretty terrible at finding something. So say you want a Base64 encoder, there's a number of them already published, but often you won't even be able to find them on the search. So people tend to go, oh, I'll just make my own and I'll publish that as a package, and continue to kind of fragment the community and their projects even more. So with libraries, I'm trying to encourage people to find the things that are well-maintained or that are reliable and have been around for a long time and used by lots of people, and suggest those, and then potentially even start to suggest that people contribute to those as well, rather than just use them.
Yeah, for sure. Have you thought about, because I haven't spoken much on it, but 24 pull requests, when I first seen this came out, when was that first release? It was a long time ago from memory.
Yeah, it's got to be like 4 years ago, I think, now.
Yeah, because I love the idea of it. I actually haven't really done too much of this. I haven't done the full 24 pull request thing. I contributed some open source projects, but not much. It's something I definitely need to get into. But have you thought about integrating that with Libraries.io, or maybe it already has and I've missed it? But
Yes, I really want to do that this year. Last year, I ran out of time to be able to push enough information in there. But this year, I've been collecting all of the GitHub issues and pull requests across all of these open source projects as well. So there's about 10 million, I think, in the database right now. And those can be used to give you an indication of kind of the average response time for a maintainer. So if you, for a given GitHub repository, you could go, oh, well, on average for the Ruby on Rails repository, you'll get a response within a day. Whereas for some projects, you might not get a response until kind of a couple months later, or you might never get a response. And we can actually use that to make better recommendations. So we can suggest projects that you can contribute to that will have someone that is very likely to respond, which is really encouraging, rather than if you spent time sending, kind of putting together a nice pull request, send it along, and then you never hear back, which is really kind of disappointing, especially if you've put a lot of time in it or it's your first pull request.
Yeah, for sure. I do know there's a thing, like everyone asks to make sure that you give a really good pull request or a really nice, write a really nice issue. But then when you don't get that feedback for a long time, it's a bit disheartening. You're like, well, I tried to do it right and, you know, it just kind of blew up in my face kind of thing.
Exactly. And that can really kill, like, a new person coming into the community would potentially kind of not try again. Unless they really fought that, like, oh, I should find someone else who's more supportive of me. And if we can avoid suggesting those projects that aren't very responsive, then point people at the ones that really want new contributors and are really friendly, then they should have more success to begin with, which should hopefully lead to them doing more contributions in the long term.
Yeah, for sure. Because that's one of the things I've found a lot of people don't do as much. They use open source so much, but there's just this failure to give back, you know. It just seems to be one of those things. Like most people you'll ask, oh, have you contributed to a project? Even like they might use, say, a framework like Foundation or Bootstrap, but they've never actually contributed back to it at all. It's one of those things that I keep finding when I go to meetups or I talk to people. That's the same thing. Like they use it every single day, but they never even have a thought about contributing back.
Yeah, so that was the initial idea behind 24 pull requests was, well, if we can make it into kind of lots of people are doing this all at once and it's kind of like giving gifts for Christmas, then you get a little bit of a groundswell and a kind of a like, oh, if all my friends are doing this or everyone in my company is doing this, then I should do this as well. And then it became kind of a bit of a movement and it's been running every year and kind of growing every year. I think it's doubled every year of the amount of pull requests and the amount of people that have been involved, which is brilliant.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So I just want to say thanks for making this initiative possible and putting it out there, because I think it definitely has helped the open source industry quite a lot as a whole.
Oh, that's all right. So many other people worked on the project as well. I really kind of planted the seed, and then I think there must be at least over 300 people that have contributed to 24 pull requests in some way or another.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize the number was so high.
Yeah, I've never had so many people contributing to one of my repos before. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, it's a great cause, and you know, I fully believe in it. I think it's fantastic. So it's good to see that it's getting the assistance and the growth that it deserves. Yeah, so I wanted to touch on a bit with Dependency CI. Because it is fairly new. How long has it been released for now, like officially released?
3 weeks, I think. So it's really only just kind of getting started, and that's with maybe 4 weeks of development so far. So it's very early on.
Yeah, and I suppose that four-week ramp-up time was made fairly quick, seeing as you used a lot of the parts of Libraries.io in that process.
Yeah, so it uses the Libraries.io API to get all of its information. So it's not duplicating the work that Libraries does, but it means that the more popular dependency CI gets, the more kind of it is working Libraries very hard.
For sure. And I think it's a great idea. This is something I think most businesses should have. If you're kind of got any business that relies on, you know, any kind of third-party library, it's essential to have.
Yeah. And there's a few existing systems that will you kind of run as a six-month or a yearly kind of batch job where it'll review all of your dependencies and look for license and security related things. But if you have such a long kind of cycle of doing that, you end up running into issues where, we can't really use this dependency because it's licensed in a way that doesn't let us work with it. But we've built a lot of functionality on the top of it over the last 6 months. So it's really painful to remove because we didn't realize until we actually ran this review. So the idea of dependency CI is just like continuous integration for your tests, is to run it as frequently as possible so that you get early warnings of potentially bad dependencies that are in your application.
Yeah, for sure. So this is one of the things that I really try and push people towards. If you can get a tool that you have to do a really minor amount of work to actually use in your workflow, in your projects, but give it, you know, that gives you a lot of value back, you should definitely use those. So if you're using some kind of CLI tool that makes you a bit more productive with, say, GitHub, or maybe like your project, your framework like Rails or Laravel or something like that, it's definitely something you should use because you don't really want to have to be thinking about when to do these things all the time. It should just happen. And having systems like this, like any kind of CI, for example, it makes a huge difference to your life and to your team.
Right, and potentially saves you a lot of pain in the future when, say, if you're working for a startup and the startup's going to raise some money or potentially sell to another company, then they're going to want to check every single dependency of all of your projects to make sure that you are compliant with the law around all of those different licenses. And that could potentially be really painful if you are using licenses that libraries that have no license or things that have security vulnerabilities in them, and you could end up finding out that you've built on top of things that have potentially even relicensed your code. If you're depending on copyleft licenses and you're actually selling your software or putting it on the App Store, then that license has a way of kind of carrying on up the dependency tree and could potentially relicense your code, which could get you into all kinds of awkward situations.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing too, so dependency CI will actually check if there's no licenses.
Yeah. So it's using libraries will check for licenses that are declared in the package manager when a library is published there. And it'll check in the GitHub repository to see if there is a license file. So it falls back to trying to find a license in a number of different places. And then right now, the dependency CI will just check for the existence of a known license. While I'm planning in the future, is then you can set up a whitelist or a blacklist to say, we don't want any of these licenses, or we only accept these set of licenses.
Yeah, for sure. And working in open source so much, it definitely becomes a serious thing. Like, for example, where I work, we've just launched a product called Easel. It's a web-to-print product. And we do pull in a fair few different open source libraries and things like that through our gemfile in Rails, as well as through our Node client. And making sure that kind of stuff is fine and good, like say if we end up wanting to sell it or if something happens with some kind of licensing, it's good to know where everything is at. So having the ability to have a service like this makes a pretty big difference to us.
Yeah, you're reducing the risk for your business and for you personally, but also if it's too much work, if it becomes a chore, then you're just not going to do it. So dependency CI, kind of if everything's fine, it's not going to ask anything of you. It's going to silently continue to check every time you push to GitHub. It's only when there's something wrong is it going to say like, oh, here's something you need to do, which is the best way to kind of stop it becoming a chore.
Yeah, exactly. And that's probably the best way to explain it is, you know, stop it becoming a chore. It's like with our Rails projects, we have like a health health check script that runs through and makes sure that we're not violating any kind of best practices and making sure we're not leaving security loopholes, and that just runs when it needs to run kind of thing. And having that in there certainly makes our lives so much easier. But the one of the things that slips away, I think, for most people and where services like this really shine is it's so easy to, you know, NPM install a project and save it on, like a plugin or a module, and just have it in there and not even think about these things. And later on, it's going to come and bite you.
Yeah, and it's different for different projects, right? As you're early, when you get started with a project, you're kind of trying to spike out an idea and you're not necessarily thinking about what am I going to do running this in production or maintaining this over the long term. You just kind of want to get something going. But then once actually people start depending on that thing and it becomes core to whatever you're doing, then you need to shift gears and to think about it in a different kind of way, rather than you kind of, or at least the way that I approach it is to slightly slow down and take a bit more of a kind of a reluctant approach to it. So rather than just trying to pile things on, I'm trying to be like, do I really need this? Do I need to add this? Can I do this in a simpler way that requires less code? Because I'm going to have to be maintaining this for another 5 years. And I really don't want to be carrying kind of, especially with the average node project now, you could end up with 1,000 transitive dependencies. So you're kind of depending on a lot of different people in the open source community to keep up with all of those individual dependencies and make sure they don't have any security vulnerabilities and they work with the latest versions of Node and they work with their other dependencies in your tree. And that's becomes a huge burden over the long term. But initially, you don't really notice because the project works and I can ship it and get on to the next thing.
Yeah, that's right. Like we've found with, because our client, we've built it in React, and we've found that there's been a lot of times when we can easily just create it ourselves and know that like every line of code that's in there and it's fine and we don't have to worry about anything like that. So having something else in place for those times when you can't do those things, because sometimes you just don't have the time to do that.
Absolutely, yeah. You're taking on, you're kind of outsourcing the knowledge, especially when it comes to things like database drivers. I don't need to understand the binary protocol for talking to Postgres. Someone else has already solved that problem for me. But that means that if I run into a bug with it, then I'm dependent on that person to fix it because I didn't learn about that in the upfront.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Just reminded me some thoughts because you've actually tweeted about some other projects you want to start. It seems like you have quite a lot of projects. You were talking about looking to do like a pub sub hubbub kind of thing, and as well as a Creative Commons for libraries.
Yeah, so pub sub hubbub for Git repositories would be really interesting, and I want to start that soon. Libraries initially started out as a pure discovery tool. So how can I find new projects or projects that are interesting? And trying to keep up with all of those around the internet, that especially with GitLab allowing people to run their own instances anywhere, there's no central source of where's all of the projects and how do I keep up with all of the ones that have been updated or pushed to recently. And there's a project like that for RSS called Superfeeder, which produces essentially, it sits in the middle of the RSS producers and the RSS readers, and the RSS producers will push to Superfeeder to say, there's a new article on my blog and I've updated my RSS feed. So can you kind of tell everyone else who's interested in this? So you can get almost real-time notifications of RSS feeds without having to like everyone polling all the RSS feeds all the time. It's just one project in the middle that receives a notification from the publisher and then it tells everyone else. And I thought that would be really neat to do that for Git repositories. So you could do it for GitHub using their firehose and kind of listening for all of the pushes to new or to existing GitHub repositories. But for GitLab, there's nothing like that. And for bare Git repositories or Bitbucket, there's nothing like that either. So I thought you could have essentially a post-commit hook where it can post to a service somewhere on the internet that can be told, oh, there's a new thing. Like if anyone is subscribed to updates for that Git repository, then go tell them so that they don't need to be doing a Git pull on however many Git repositories they're interested in. So it kind of decentralizes that push of information a little bit. So it allows people to put their Git repositories anywhere, but be a central point of updates and information. Does that make sense?
I've never seen someone use RSS in that way before. That's really interesting what they did with RSS.
So that actually works with most RSS readers, and Google Reader was a big user of that. But it all happens kind of transparently behind the scenes. So you can still poll the direct RSS feed, but you can also just subscribe to Superfeeder and say, can you just tell me when there's a new thing on this feed? And it will then do the work for you. And the idea being that if there's many people listening to that feed, then it reduces the amount of work overall. And they provide that service almost completely for free. I think if you want to subscribe to hundreds of thousands of RSS feeds, then you have to pay. But most of the work is free.
That's interesting. So when you take that kind of model to do your project, do you see that being hard to implement? Or
It ends up being pretty similar, I think. Because so a lot of the hosted Git services like GitLab and GitHub and Bitbucket will provide an RSS feed. So it can piggyback on a lot of the stuff that Superfeed has already done. The main bit of work will be some kind of script that you can install on your Git repositories that after it receives a commit will be able to push to that service to say there's a new commit. And then making it in a way that can be mirrorable so other people can run it and it doesn't become a central point of failure for the community.
For sure. So I suppose my thoughts would go to like a post-commit hook kind of thing, but is that possible to do it in that scenario or does it have to be something else?
Yeah, you can definitely do a post-commit either locally for individual users or you could do it on the server where Git is if it has an internet connection. And the problem comes with Bitbucket and GitHub is that I can't encourage them to do that as well. So that yeah. Needs to watch those things in a slightly different way.
Yeah, for sure. You certainly give yourself some interesting problems to solve.
Yeah,
it's interesting it to see like where it goes.
Sometimes it tends towards what I guess Google is doing a lot for the web. It's just a subset of the web, trying to keep on top of updates for all the open source code and then to use the dependency graph a little bit like Google PageRank. So you can end up kind of working out what are the most important things in this network. But most of the work feels like I'm kind of doing what Google did many years ago.
Yeah, it's really fascinating stuff. Have there been any major pain points that you really struggled with?
So the current area that I'm having fun with is package managers that have their manifest files that are essentially Turing complete. So there are projects like actually RubyGems, the gem file is just a Ruby file. And Clojure provides its kind of, I think it's package project.clj, which is a Clojure file. And those things, to get the list of dependencies from them, you really need to execute the file or pass them with a regular expression or similar. And some of them I've done fairly well, but there are some like Gradle, which is the kind of Android, the thing that's mostly used for Android development package management, that is written in Groovy, or at least the file is written in Groovy, and trying to write a regular expression to pass that is a kind of a path to madness. So I've been looking into how I could run the client in some kind of a container, maybe like a Linux container that is sandboxed away, because I can't trust if someone gives me a Gradle file that just has some Ruby, some Groovy code in it that will kind of delete everything on the system, then I have to protect the rest of the system from that, which is really tricky. It is kind of ends up being, I guess, a subset of like running a whole platform as a service where you have to take other people's untrusted code and run it and then hope that the response comes back as you expect and fail gracefully if it doesn't.
Yeah, for sure. It's kind of a scary thing when you're passing other people's data and you've got to really be really careful. And it's easy to get complacent, I think, about those things. And I couldn't imagine what it'd be like trying to pass all these files. Like, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit painful. The other thing to remember when you're installing stuff locally is that any NPM module or any Ruby gem could just run some arbitrary shell script as part of its post-install process. So never use sudo as you do that, because you're essentially allowing a malicious package to run like any command with complete control on your computer.
Yeah, for sure. Like, what are your thoughts on, say, like Docker, for example, so these LXC kind of containers? Do you think that's going to improve security for projects as well as kind of reduce potential malicious code?
Potentially, yes. That seems like one of the biggest uses for them. I don't see them as being particularly helpful for portability, partly because you don't really move things around that much. It's much more kind of like important to protect the security of those things. But you can also end up introducing slightly different security issues along with them, where you're pulling in a Docker hub image from somewhere that you really don't introspect and look into and see kind of like, okay, well, I've just pulled in this Docker hub. What things are installed on it already? Does it have kind of like, is that posting my private code out to somewhere else? And those are kind of much harder to see what's going on inside than, say, looking inside of a node module, which has no kind of, at least it's almost all going to be plain text files, but you've got binaries that will be hidden inside those Docker images that you're downloading that you have no idea what they're doing inside of.
Right. That's really interesting. I never actually thought of that. Because I know I like Docker simply because of getting like a development set up across a team. It makes that very easy and less headaches. You know, making sure, okay, if you have this project, we rely on X and Y software. You got to make sure you install that and its particular version. It makes that a lot easier. But I never really thought too much past that point where the portability, it's not really that big of a gain.
Well, if you're the thing to remember is if you're building your own Docker images completely from scratch, then you're probably not going to run into those security things quite as much. Although you do have to make sure you keep all of your Docker images up to date and essentially keep rebuilding or like republishing them every time that there's, say, a new system level dependencies being updated. Because otherwise, if you're publishing those Docker images into production, you're potentially not keeping up with all of the like the Debian security updates and things like that.
Yeah, that's right. And I suppose that would, because Docker uses the host kernel, I'm sure there could be issues with the kernel too that could be exploited. Is that, do you know much in regards to that? Or
I don't really know much. I'm kind of just starting to get into that world. I'm looking into how I can index the system level packages and things like that. But there are some tools that I've seen that actually will kind of, given a Docker image, will go in and introspect them and look for known security issues, which could be a good way of alleviating some of that pain.
Interesting. Yeah, it's certainly an interesting world. It seems like everyone's, you know, on the container bandwagon, and it's still fairly new, but there's a lot of these things, I think, that are just starting to slowly come out of the woodwork now. It's interesting to see and watch.
Yeah, I've not really been using it for much. Most of libraries, the main Rails app runs on a bare dedicated machine and doesn't use any containers or any extra kind of things, but I'm in complete control of that machine. And all of the kind of extra services that do individual little things are running on Heroku.
So that's interesting. So your stack is primarily Rails still?
Yeah, libraries, actually 24 Progress and Dependency CI are all Rails apps. And they're kind of all just still rendering HTML on the server and doing fairly standard things. And then there's auxiliary services to do individual kind of bits of parsing or to run parts of the API, which will usually communicate with the main Rails app over HTTP. And usually that's done inside of a Sidekick background job. So either libraries is going and asking for information or posting off to one of the little Sinatra apps or a Node app to say, can you pass this thing for me? And then some things are actually posting directly into the Sidekick queue for libraries, which is quite nice because it's language agnostic. As long as you know what kind of, you just give it some data and then there's a Ruby job that will pick it up and work on it as stuff comes into the queue.
Yeah, for sure. Have you found managing like the smaller little auxiliary applications? Like, how have you found working with that while testing and developing your projects?
So I generally test each individual thing with some integration tests or some unit tests, and then I'll put it on Heroku and kind of forget about it. So where the error monitoring will actually just be in the main Rails app. So when it tries to talk to that service, if it runs into an issue, it'll throw an exception, which will be tracked in Bugsnag, and emailed to me when there's like, usually I find out that a service is falling over because it's throwing a lot of exceptions as things are trying to talk to it.
Right. And that kind of leads me to a point that like everyone's going on about different stacks, and like you've kept to the Rails stack by the sounds. And there's this article that came out, which I've seen that you tweeted about, and it was Uncle Bob Martin's one about code churn.
I found that really interesting.
Yeah, like it was a great read, and it's very easy to get, you know, obsessed with the new and shiny. You know, it's great. Like, oh, cool, here's Elixir or here's, you know, Elm or something like that. But definitely, I think sticking, like if anyone hasn't read the article, I highly recommend it. It's a must read. How do you find the churn? Like, do you get thoughts like, oh, it'd be great to use this language? Or are you just like, well, you know, Rails is perfect for me for what I do. You know, I may as well just stick with that.
So I've been fighting the urge to play with Elixir and Phoenix and kind of teaching myself little bits of it on the side. But to be honest, I'm scared of the Erlang runtime and trying to keep that kind of in check in production because it's really quite involved. So it might be really easy to roll out a little Elixir app, but if you start running into issues with OTP and the Erlang VM, I have no experience in debugging those things. And I've got lots of experience in debugging what's going on inside of a Ruby application. So for production things that are part of kind of the critical path, which for libraries is serving the web pages and kind of making sure that all of the background jobs are run successfully. It doesn't really need to be. Most of these new things don't solve any new problems. They just kind of solve either slightly different things or they're kind of dropping some of the legacy that exists in other kind of, the Rails has some legacy problems that Phoenix drops to make it easier to do WebSockets and to make it a bit more performant. But I'm still running one server of Rails and it's handling something like 100,000 visitors a week with very little problems. The scaling all comes down to the database rather than Rails being a performance bottleneck. So I haven't really found that those kind of things have become a problem. Like, I guess there are companies that have much bigger scale issues than I have, and those would help with those problems. But most startups don't have anywhere near the scale of those issues, but they seem to jump for the new shiny stuff because it's interesting rather than focusing on solving their actual users' problems.
Yeah, for sure. Because I'd started playing around with Elixir as well, because I thought, I do object-oriented programming. Great to see what a functional language is really like. And then you read that article and it does make sense. You know, it's just solving the same problem in a slightly different way. So you're not really getting much more value from that.
Yeah, there's definitely interesting things to play around with and to learn from those ideas. But there's a really good tweet that basically says, if you're excited about something, then you shouldn't be running it in production, because that probably means that you don't know enough about it to make sure that in the middle of the night when it starts acting really strangely and people who are depending on your website are having trouble or can't use it, then you're kind of stuck. And there's a load of already existing technology that can do most of what you need that has kind of a much broader set of knowledge and experience and ways of finding out how to solve those problems.
Yeah, for sure. It really does bring things back to reality. It gets that the starry eyes kind of just fades away when you read those kind of articles and those kind of tweets. So I just wanted to finish up the episode, I just want to talk about, how do you kind of decide to pick your projects? Because you have done some projects, and while dependency CI and libraries are kind of well connected and 24 pull requests in a way, like, how do you decide on what you want to work on next or what you want to put more of your time into?
So I used to kind of be a little bit all over the place. I did lots of projects with Nodecopter, which is where you control quadcopters with JavaScript. And that kind of led on to making node controlled Lego robots and all kinds of different things. And that was more just kind of fun hobby like things. Most of the side projects that I've been working on have been something that scratches an itch for myself. So libraries came around because I was struggling to use different searches for different package managers because they were generally awful. And I wanted some way of building like a useful search so that I could find things to build the next project on top of. It's just that libraries ended up becoming a long running thing. I don't know how, if there's, I guess it's just something that if you find that project that is slightly on the edge of your knowledge or your skill set, where it challenges you, but it doesn't feel impossible. But it's also something that you're interested in, because if you haven't got those kind of two things, a bit of challenge and a bit of interest, then you're going to very quickly get bored of it.
Yeah, for sure. Sure. So what would your kind of advice to people would be, is just to make sure it's something that you're interested in, it's going to give you a challenge?
Yeah, I think so. And the things that I like to work on generally have some kind of multiplier effect for a community or some group of people. So libraries, I'm hoping, will have the effect of, if it can help people find good quality libraries, then it can have a knock-on effect of an improvement in those bits of software as well. So rather than it just being like a simple tool, it can actually have a greater improvement. But that's, I guess, slightly bigger project than, say, something simple where you can solve someone's problem with some nice bit of code and kind of make it so that it doesn't become a huge bit of pain to maintain because you're not interested in it, for example.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, because I think that's what a lot of people find hard doing, is picking something that they want to do. Like, everyone kind of wants to do something that's outside of their work hours that's fun to work on, but they always struggle to find some kind of idea or something to do.
Yeah, and don't necessarily worry about if other people are going to find it interesting or if you're going to get on Hacker News or GitHub Explore with it, but do something that will keep your interest, because then you're more likely to build something that will kind of be a long running thing rather than just a little flash, which then you won't go back and kind of want to continue to work on.
For sure. And that kind of leads me into my second last question here, is like, what do you do to get away from work?
So I have two miniature poodles, which are incredibly distracting for work. So they love to, I love to take them out on long walks. I live in the countryside. It's great to get out. I also run a couple of meetups, which are more social meetups rather than kind of like networking events. And that's a really good way to get outside of the regular kind of work environment. I work from home as well, so I don't see people quite as often as if you work in an office. And then I play a lot of Xbox as well. It's a great way, if I play a challenging game, then it, you can't think about anything else other than the game. So you can't think about that code problem that you were thinking of before. It's a good way to switch off.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I do something similar. Like I work remote most of the time. It's a couple of days a week that I go into the offices, and you know, gaming's a bit of my outlet as well as surfing and a few other things. But it definitely helps to have something that takes your full attention and you can stop thinking about code for a little bit, because I find that my head's always in it. You know, working full time, then running a couple of little projects of my own and a couple of meetup groups and stuff. It's easy to keep all that stuff in your head at all times. It's not very good or not very healthy for you.
Yeah, I've been trying not to do that with my inbox as well. So trying to, when I've finished work, to try and shut all my notifications off and things like that, because otherwise I'll keep getting reminded that there's something that I still need to do, or that someone else is kind of waiting for some bit of work to happen. And if you just live like that constantly, then you'll just go mad.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think it's also hard too, because most people who work on the web, that, you know, we love what we kind of do, and it's easy to just to get drawn into that and just be constantly connected and constantly into whatever we're working on. So I think it's more, we have to make more of a conscious effort to kind of get out of that kind of space.
Definitely. That just because you love doing it, if you continue to take on all of that kind of extra responsibility, then you're going to end up burning out, because you need time to switch off. Even if you don't realize it initially, eventually it'll come and catch you up.
For sure. Oh, well, it's been great having you on the show. Hopefully you've had a good time. I just want to say, like, how do people contact you? You know, if someone wants to come and, you know, put forth and say, I want to help you with any of your upcoming projects, or if they just want to, you know, send a tweet to you or anything like that, like, how is the best way to contact you with anything in regards to that?
So I'm on Twitter as TBass, and Andrew on GitHub. I think my GitHub account has my email address on there. And if you're interested in contributing to libraries, then the GitHub repository is the best place to kind of open an issue and either see the existing things that are on there, or potentially kind of look to start some new area of it, then open up an issue before sending a pull request, just so I can make sure that you're not duplicating work that someone else is doing.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure people will get a lot of value out of this show. So thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
No worries. All right, so that ends the show for this week. So if you have any questions or follow up or anything like that, you can leave a tweet at CodaCatchUp, or you can send through an email to codacatchup@gmail.com, or you can even leave a comment on codacatchup.com for this episode. Also, just want to make sure, leading up to September, if you're going to be on the Gold Coast in Australia, I'm holding a CodePen meetup on the 15th of September, so you can get to that. There's a link in the show notes to the invite page where you can RSVP your spot. It's free. Come and talk all about front end, anything like that. There's free food, free drinks, so I'd love to see you there. But other than that, we'll catch the next episode.